Okay, well, comrades, obviously this discussion was triggered by the financial panic that started at the end of August and is now continuing. So I'm going to spend most of my time on developments in the world economy and going on from there to Britain later on. But I'd like to start off by dealing with a secular trend, a long-term trend in the capitalist economy, because it has significance for things that have been going on in the 21st century. And that secular trend is the increasing significance and increasing grip of finance capital in the capitalist economy. This distinction existed in Marx's time, that he did divide the capitalist class, apart from the landed gentry, into what he called functioning capitalists, who actually set up capitalist concerns and attempted to make surplus value out of workers like that, and money capitalists, who just sat on their backsides, lent money to functioning capitalists, and waited for interest, which was their share of the surplus value, to come in. And of course he was aware that you've got the emergence of financial intermediaries such as banks and other financial institutions, which actually put the lenders and the borrowers together and, guess what, took their cut for so doing. But money capitalists were quite a significant section of the population 100 years ago. I don't know how many comrades have seen these films that are based on E.M. Forster books and set in the Edwardian period, but there are all these people, they're quite nice sort of Merchant Ivory type of costume drama things, but there are all these people who never do any work. They just sort of swan around and they go to trips to Italy and places like this and Florence, or they kick around the countryside here, and not a single one of them ever does any work. And there were actually about 500,000 of these rentiers 100 years ago, who just lived by owning government securities or Argentinian railroad bonds and things like that, and didn't do any work at all. Now, things have moved on a bit from that time. If you look at the 1960s, for instance, finance capital was creaming off about 15% of all the profits, of all the surplus value, produced by the working class as a whole. It's now estimated, it's quite difficult to estimate it accurately, that they're probably getting 40% of the total surplus value accrues to finance capital in various forms. There's an acronym that they use quite a lot in the States called FIRE, which is finance, insurance and real estate. And this is an increasingly significant sector of the capitalist system. I mean, for goodness sake, we've got Canary Wharf over there, and there's tens of thousands of people pour into there, at least 50,000, and probably about 300,000 more that go into the City of London just to deal with financial manipulations. What is different is it's not just a simple, naive matter of marrying people who want to lend money and then, on the other hand, other people who want to borrow it, such as manufacturing capitalists. What they've actually done now, and this is quite important for our story, is they've, it's a horrible word, they've securitized debts. They've actually turned them into financial instruments. There was a tendency to do this even in Marx's day, because if you are an owner of means of production, which most of us are not, you own them in the form of shares, in other words, of pieces of paper. And as a result of you owning this share, you're going to get dividends coming on a regular basis, which of course represent a share of someone else's unpaid labour. But that has led to the sort of mindset of people with money that you can just run out and buy pieces of paper and they will entitle you to an income stream as long as you hold that piece of paper. And Marx called this fictitious capital. So you start off with the idea that the piece of paper represents your ownership of the means of production, therefore you can get money. you move from there to the idea that, well, any bit of paper that entitles you to get money must be capital. Well, it is capital in one sense, and it's getting you money, and you can go out and spend that money on a sports car or whatever you fancy, as much as you can if you own part of the means of production. But another sense, it's not, because it's just, and this is the incredible thing, it's somebody else's debt. Somebody else owes somebody money, they have to pay them, so they make up a piece of paper which involves all these little bits of debt, and what is a debt for one person is an asset for somebody else. And there's been these incredibly complicated financial instruments. The financial sector describes itself as very innovative, and what they're mainly innovating is these fantastically complicated bits of paper. They're probably not even bits of paper, they probably only exist on a computer these days, which they use. So you've got this securitization. In other words, instead of just having simple lenders of money and other borrowers of money, you have these loans being bundled up and sold all over the world. Associated with that is another trend, which is an equally ugly expression, which you're not going to like, and that is financialization. That there are a lot of capitalists who are not actually finance capitalists, but think in finance capital type of ways. I went into Boots to buy some razor blades a couple of weeks ago. Now, the point about Boots is it looks exactly the same as it did 6 months ago. They sell the same razor blades and the same other sort of quite boring stuff that Boots sells. But it was taken over by a private equity concern called KKR. And KKR reckon that they can make more money out of it. Now, in the old days, the way you would make more money is by inventing a better razor blade or something like that. That was our concept of capitalist competition. These days, you just take over a firm, you don't change anything about it, and you just, what's the expression, sweat the resources. You just try and squeeze as much out of it as possible. In other words, if you've got a branch of Boots in, I don't know, High Holborn or somewhere, well, then the rental is going to be something phenomenal. So you actually get them to lease. You actually buy the property and they get Boots to lease it. Well, all you're doing is ripping Boots off. This is fairly obvious. You're not actually developing the productive forces in any way whatsoever. And capitalists in the 19th century, however deeply unpleasant they may have been, had to develop the productive forces. But these days, they're not thinking in those terms at all. They're thinking of how can we make more money from the existing setup? And that is a new mindset. So, you know, in the old days, you had a situation where banks were institutions that hang on to money. In fact, there was a bloke called Willie Sutton who was asked, why do you rob banks? And he said, that's where they keep the money. And they don't keep the money in banks, or at least they don't keep it for decades and decades in the way that you probably think a bank is a very large piggy bank, and that you go in and put your money in and it just sits there until such time as you get it out. The whole point is that they get a debt or something and they'll bundle it up and pass it on. It's a merry old game of pass the parcel. So whereas financial assets, which don't forget are somebody else's debts, represented 109% of gross domestic product of the world in 1980, they were greater than the whole national income of the world, or the output of the world, it's now 316% of the world's output. And that was last year. So three times as much as the output of the world consists of paper securities that are bundling about. The last count, and obviously it changes all the time, in 2005, it was 140,000 billion, which I'm told is $140 trillion of these financial assets going around. So the figures are obviously just astronomical. But I think that might be a useful bit of background to dealing with how world capitalism has developed in the 21st century. We had a recession in 2001. For us, that was the mildest recession since 1974. We basically divide the period since the Second World War into two periods. The great post-war boom started around about 1948 and came to a definitive end in 1974. And the period since then, which has been a return to a more sort of normal pattern of capitalism, with quite long periods of mass unemployment. Now, the recession in 2001 went on to 2002, wasn't even a recession at all in technical terms in the UK. Technically, a recession is two quarters of actually declining output over a, in other words, over a six-month period. Technically, we didn't hit a recession in Britain over that time. There was a slowdown. The economy was moving markedly slower. The USA, most of the other advanced capitalist countries did go into recession, but the recession was not that marked. And since that time, since they came out of recession 2003-2004, the world economy has been growing at a rate of around about 5% a year. And this is very unusual for the period since 1974, because those are the sort of rates of growth that we associate with the golden era of the post-war boom. And it's a basic axiom of what we say, that that period is gone forever. So we have to have a look at the situation very carefully and say, well, is that true, what we say, that we're now into a more normal period, that that was a freak, one-off period of post-war boom? Well, if you look at the division of the growth in the economy since about 2003, you can see that the high-income economies, the USA, Western Europe, on average have been growing at about 2.8% a year. This is nothing special. This is more or less a sort of trend rate of growth that we've seen since 1974. In fact, in the case of Britain, we're actually growing slightly faster, for reasons that I'll discuss when we get to Britain, than we have been doing in recent years. But it does seem that in the case of British capitalism, it is written into its karma that it grows on average at a trend rate of growth of about 2.25% a year. And this has actually been the case since 1780. Nobody knows why, but basically when British capitalism is growing, it's growing at about 2.25% a year. Well, we've been growing about 2.5%, maybe a little bit more, the last 2 or 3 years. But I'll try and explain why that might be the case. But then you look at the so-called emerging economies, and they've been growing at 7.8% a year since 2000 a year. They're the ones that are contributing to this growth rate of for the world of 5% a year since 2003. And obviously, Chinese people individually are much poorer than American people, but there are 1.3 billion of them, and there's 1.3 over a billion Indians. And the Chinese economy is growing at the incredible level of 11% at the present time. And India is also growing at a rate of 9%. And they've both got fairly primitive stock exchanges, very primitive stock exchanges in the case of the Chinese. And these, there's huge speculation going on where the Indian stock exchange is apparently growing at 20% a year. Well, how on earth can a stock exchange grow at 20% year after year unless the working class are producing 20% more surplus value this year than they did last year, and they're going to produce 20% more surplus value next year than they did this year? And clearly, you know, you don't have that opportunity in capitalist times to increase the rate of surplus value in such a dramatic way, and therefore we have to conclude that These movements on the stock exchange in India and these prices of share quoted companies in China are speculative. They are speculative, and there's a huge amount of speculation in the world economy. We're going to discuss later on who actually leads world economic growth, but I'm going to say that it's still the USA. And the USA has been growing, next year will grow at less than 2%. Everyone agrees that, and quite a lot of people, Greenspan, the OECD, people like that are saying it's 50-50 that there'll be a recession. They haven't factored in yet the events that started with the subprime loan crisis a few months ago, and the effect that that might have on the real economy. So what we see in the world economy is extreme unevenness, massive imbalances. One of the obvious imbalances is that the US population consists of, what, about 4% of the world's population. And yet apparently US consumers are responsible for 19% of world GDP. They consume 19%. This 4% of the population consumes nearly one-fifth of all the output that is produced in the world. And your obvious question is, how on earth do they do this? Because we know that American workers' living standards haven't gone up for 30 years, which is, I would think, unique in advanced capitalist countries, that real wages have been completely flat in the USA since the 1970s. So it's not their income going up, they're not spending their income, it's based on the wealth they have. And most, for most working people, their wealth consists of their house prices. And there has been a house price bubble. And so people are spending money that they basically haven't got, and they are treating their houses as ATMs, in effect. They are borrowing on the fact that their house price will go up and will continue to go up, and therefore they can buy more and more things. And there's no doubt for the last few years that the thing that has been leading the growth of the world economy, despite the fact that it's India that's growing the fastest and China that's growing the fastest, and Russia is also growing quite fast, is the US consumer. The US consumer has been the key factor in the development of the world economy since 2003. Now, this is a classic bubble, in the sense that the price of houses is going up because people are buying them. And people are buying them because the price is going up. I mean, there is no rational basis for the price of houses to go up in that sense. And that we know, in fact, we've been saying so many years that everyone's getting bored with it, that bubbles burst, and that process is reversed, and you get a situation where the house prices go down because people are selling them, and people are selling them because they are going down. The logic of the bubble reverses itself. So that's one enormous imbalance. And of course the house price bubble is not confined to the USA. As we know, we've had it in Britain, where house prices, I think, have tripled since 1997. You know, our incomes haven't tripled since 1997. They've gone up a much more modest rate, about around about 2% a year over that time. In Spain, there's been a bubble which is showing very obvious signs of bursting. Probably the biggest bubble in terms of house price rises has been in Ireland, where again there's all the signs of the bubble bursting at this stage. So that's one huge imbalance, that we've had an increase in output because of an increase in consumption. The increase in consumption is not in large part based on actual increases in people's income. It's what is actually a completely illusory increase in their wealth. I mean, most of us, I think, regard an house as bricks and mortar to keep the rain off your head, rather than as an appreciating asset. But that is what they have become. So, the situation, some of the other imbalances are that in relation between China and the USA. China is emerging as a massive manufacturing power, and they have a huge surplus with the USA. In fact, they have a situation where the surplus that they have with the USA is almost equal to the amount of government securities, T-bills they're called, that the Chinese are buying in the USA. So what in effect is happening is that the Americans are able to buy more and more things off the Chinese, despite the fact they're not selling very much to the Chinese, because the Chinese are lending them money to buy the goods. Now work it out for yourself. That is not sustainable. You know, I can sell you something for a fiver if I say, here's a fiver. And if I keep on saying, here's a fiver, buy another one off me, then you can do it. But clearly, there's going to come a stage when that will collapse. And what a lot of people have said is that the reason that might collapse is because the way that the strain will be felt is through the dollar. And the dollar has been propped up in the manner of a dead parrot for some years by this, by the fact that the Americans are, by the Chinese are buying government securities. In fact, Chinese capital inflows are the equivalent of pining for the Victorian values on the part of the dollar. But now we can see the dollar is going down. And really, the miracle is not that the dollar is going down now, with all the problems that that poses for the world economy, but the fact that it's actually remained propped up in this completely artificial way for such a long time.